other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by 100 Moms. My name's Aaron here, their personal pals Dave.
Morning, boys.
Brick.
Hello, hello.
And calling from Old Ireland, we have Old Irish Nico.
Hello.
Wonderful. Today's topic is a group read. We've read a book, dear listeners, and we're going to talk about it. This is what we do in this podcast. I think Dave was the first one to read this book. Is that correct?
Yes.
The book in question is Lincoln the Bardo by George Saunders. It came out in 2017. It won the Man Booker Prize. This is a big deal. Dave, why did you start reading this book in the first place? And then why did we read it after you?
I mean, I think I just read it because I was already a Saunders fan and it's his first novel and so far only novel. So I was, you know, I was immediately curious about it. And it, in fact, I bought it in hardcover. I can't remember the last time I'd done that before. And I don't know if I've done it since.
And why did you make that choice?
Because I wanted to read it immediately. I didn't want to have to wait a year to read it because I like Saunders that much.
Right. So this is like that. We've had this question before talking about sort of what forms do you buy in and like if it's worth it. If you want to read it, then it doesn't matter what form it's in. You just like pay for the hardback.
I mean, usually it does. There are a lot of authors who I really enjoy whose books I won't buy in hardcover because I can wait. But for this one, I didn't want to.
Yeah, you had to nut.
One of the rare. Yeah, I guess.
You can edit that out, Brick.
No, don't.
Not butter on toast.
So you read this a few times though, Dave, right?
I did. I read it, you know, immediately when I got it. I read it, and when I finished, I went right back to page one and restarted, which is another thing I don't do often.
You've done it a few times though. I think you do it more often than any of the rest of us.
Then I think.
Yeah.
Then of four of us, for sure, you definitely are more of a rereader than the others of the personal pals here.
Yeah, I reread a lot, but not often will I finish a book and then immediately restart that book.
Like chain rereading.
Right, right.
This book, I think, maybe more so than most other novels, allows you to do that. Makes it a compelling case because it is so specifically structured and organized that it feels like almost like modular reading experience. You can kind of do it on end. It's not like you have to like really go back and try and get into the feeling again because it's like it's right there for you. It's very accessible in that sense. You praise this book. You talked about it a while back in, I think maybe a year and a half ago or 2 years ago. You mentioned that it was sad, and I was like, ooh, that's like my radar sense for like sad things perked up. I was like, I want to read that for sure, because I'm a sad.
Sad boy.
Piece of shit, too.
Right.
So it was on my list, but I hadn't got around to it, and then Brick picked it up, maybe? Is that true?
Nico
picked it up. Gotcha.
Yeah, I was last.
So it became a group read, and so now we're talking about it. Basic breakdown of the plot, then we'll get into thoughts. This is, well, actually, one thing, when I've told people about this book that I'm reading it, do you guys have the same issue where no one understands what you're talking about and you have to spell out the title, like literally spell it out for them? Like whenever I said Lincoln the Bardo, they're like, really, reading what? And I'm like, Lincoln the Bardo, and I mumble.
Yeah, because nobody knows what a Bardo is.
Yeah, it's a very weird title. Doesn't roll off the tongue in that sense, or it kind of does, but it's like hard to hear those words in succession and know what it all means. So the idea here is about Abraham Lincoln, and his young son dies on the kind of like the outset of the Civil War and is interred kind of in like a temporary sort of crypt, basically in a Georgetown cemetery. And about the ghosts who populate that cemetery and try to usher him into heaven, essentially. And also Lincoln's grief. It's based on Saunders' real experiences going to that cemetery and having a friend tell him the story about how Lincoln would go after hours and like cradle his son's body in the crypt, and that he was sort of shook by this, and it sort of started this kind of supernatural story in his mind. So Dave, you love this book. Tell us why you love it so much. What speaks to you about in this book? Well, that's a horrible sentence.
You know, just it feels both light and heavy at the same time. Right, I think because of the way it's structured, it's all dialogue. The scenes that are set with the characters is all dialogue, with the attributions coming after the dialogue itself.
Yeah, almost like screenplay or dramaturge.
Or stage play-ish. Yeah. And then, you know, punctuated with both fictional and non-fictional historical accounts of, you know, various things at the time, like Willie getting sick, stuff happening with the Civil War itself. So like we were talking about before we started recording, it's the paperback is, you know, 300 and I don't know, 50-ish pages.
Yeah.
But it's a really quick read because of how it's structured. But ooh, a lot of gravitas.
Yeah, that's really the description, like heavy and light at the same time. It's like 100 some chapters, but a lot of chapters are like one page, so it's really, you can sort of breeze through it. And I did, I read it in about 2 days essentially, but the experience of reading it, and it sort of really, it packs a lot into those short bits, and you get a lot of emotion and a lot of conceptual weight, I guess, from those details. Nico, tell us your thoughts here.
Well, so when we were texting about it, one of the things that I think Brick mentioned was that he was having a hard time getting a handle on it in the beginning. And I said, yeah, I don't know still like a lot of the details of what's going on. So maybe that's something to talk about, because then that seemed to repulse Dave. He was like, what are you talking about? What do you mean you don't know the details? But I mean, for me, it was very much like the reading experience was like, I kind of just let it wash over me, getting it. And I got a sense of these ghosts kind of waiting around, and their existence is extremely fluid and kind of obviously not realistic, but also not really consistent from moment to moment. Like sometimes they'll just kind of drift into each other and occupy the same space. And then, or sometimes somebody will mention that one of them has an enormous penis that he's like throwing around everywhere. And there's like a lot of kind of surreal details like that, that kind of add up to a feeling of like, you don't know. I think that's part of the point, is that you don't really know exactly what's going on, because like some parts of it aren't told to you and some parts of it are not logical and not realistic in the sense that they would be if they were people. So what do you think? So then you were kind of, you seem to be surprised by that, Dave, that we weren't really holding on to details.
Yeah, I guess I'm not entirely sure what you mean when you talk about details. Like you said something about like you had a hard time telling the characters apart or something, or like latching onto the characters.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. Like getting a whole picture of them in the way that you would in a normal novel, partly because there's so many of them, and partly because some of the chapters were like where it was really long, like you wouldn't even know who was talking until like you'd have, or I'd be flipping back and forth to see who was talking, because all right, the attributions come at the end. But then also there's things like, so I think one of the most concise examples of this sense that I had of not really understanding or really caring about the details, that might not be the right word, but like I didn't get put a lot of attention into them instead of just kind of getting the sense of it, was Lieutenant Stone, who like goes around talking about shards all the time. And oh, it's yeah, like, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. And nobody else seems to either. But it's just like, okay, that's just what he does, I guess.
Yeah, I think it took me a while to realize they were characters. And it wasn't really until Willie dies and it starts, the actual death of the kid happens, you know, maybe page 50, close to it. And then, and maybe I read this book wrong, but eventually it felt like there was kind of two main movers of the plot. And one was that chorus of ghost voices. And then the other was kind of the Lincoln-specific parts, which seemed to be cobbled together through newspaper articles and biographies and stuff. I don't think those were ghosts also, but maybe they were. I don't know. So it seemed, and once I kind of realized like, oh, this is kind of like a patchwork of biography, and it's kind of the Lincoln stuff, and then this is the chorus of ghosts, that's when it started. It was a lot easier for me to kind of figure out how to read it. And I might have read it wrong, but it started making more sense that way. And then I started to kind of understand that the different ghosts had kind of more voices, and then they had their own stories that were working their way in and out, and it was almost like a hyper-literal Haunted Mansion from Disney's World, right? Is that what it's called? Haunted Mansion?
Yeah, Haunted Mansion.
Yeah.
No, you're right. This is an example of a book that teaches you how to read it as you read it, right? I'm thinking of Clockwork Orange as an example of that too, where the vocabulary of Nadsat, their sort of like future language, you have to kind of learn as you go. And once you get it handled by around chapter 3 or 4, you're golden. Same thing I hear the first couple chapters, I was like, I don't quite get the connections, and I had the same question of like, oh, are these
like, who the fuck's Hans Voller?
Yeah, and I was like, oh, he must be famous. I started doing some Google digging, trying to figure out who these people were, and then the results were confusing, so I went back to it. And then by a couple like 10 pages in, I had figured it out, and that was good from there. One thing I know, so there's three main, I guess four main voices here. There's obviously Willie Lincoln, who's an important voice, and there's the three sort of main ghosts. There's Blevins, who is the closeted, like the young gay man, right, I think. And then there was Hans Vollmann, who was the older man who was married to like a teenager who he refused to like have sex with, and then the night they were supposed to have sex, he died. That's why he has a giant ghost erection. And then there was the Reverend Thomas. And so those three voices kind of like are our main characters, I would say, for the novel. And the other voices kind of come in and out, and they sort of have, you know, some are here and there. Like there's like kind of like profane couple, like they swear a lot, and their obscenities are kind of like blanched out, which is kind of funny. They kind of come back. They're like minor characters, and there's some that like appear once and never come back. There's a couple sort of are bookend the novel. They're in the present or in the beginning and the very end. That's about it. One thing that I noticed is as you read the chapters, at some points the distinction between Blevins and Vollmann are important, and sometimes they're not. And I can only imagine it's care and craft that makes those moments really work. Like at some point I found myself like, you can kind of like sort of blend them in your head as you read. And at some points sort of like they separate out, become more distinct, and they sort of have their own identities. They kind of have a shared voice. It's a really interesting move that I haven't really seen done before.
Yeah. It almost replicates that feeling of them talking at the same time.
Yeah.
But somehow you're able to, you know, it does feel like a chorus, and not necessarily in like the Greek definition, but in like the musical. Like it seems like you're getting a lot of different, because sometimes they're sort of going back and forth, and sometimes they're kind of going concurrent. You know what I mean? And eventually, once you get used to those rhythms, it just becomes very natural when you read.
Yeah, I thought of harmonies when I was reading this novel. It's like a harmonic structure that I guess I have seen it before, and I was thinking of Sound of the Fury is an example of that, where you're reading it and you have all these voices competing for space, but Faulkner forces you to sort of decipher it yourself, whereas Saunders gives you a bit more with the sort of screenplay formatting of it. You can sort of more easily kind of figure out who's saying what, so there is more of a voice. But it
made me think of As I Lay Dying.
Oh yeah, totally.
When you mentioned Faulkner, it also reminded me a lot of Ulysses and the Virgin Suicides were books that I kept thinking about, not necessarily exactly, but it's doing some of those things in different ways. But those are books that are kind of really, because I've never read a book like this.
Yeah, it's like those are like the As I Lay Dying approach. This is like diced up even further, right? Because those are like individual chapters where the voice goes on for 10, 20 pages, sometimes shorter than that. But this is like, you get every chapter is, you might get 15 voices. You kind of figured out it's like micro dosing As I Lay Dying.
But I feel like he quickly alerts you to who to pay attention to and who is just part of the chorus. Mm-hmm. Right, it would be a much different book if all of the ghosts were just this chorus of voices. But he gives us those three main ones, and then Willie on top of it to say, like, latch on to these characters. These are the ones you're going to be following. And then here's all these other people who are going to add color, but it doesn't necessarily matter, like, who is who. Like, keeping them apart is not as important.
Yeah, like the relationships between those core three and Willie are the most important, and you kind of come back to them most consistently. And then, like you said, the other characters pop up as these little bits of color and intrigue. It really does feel like, I mean, so Saunders is a short story writer primarily. This is his only novel so far. And I even read this, a quote in an interview. He was like, I was kind of proud of not having written a novel, and I didn't want to, because I wanted to like just thumb my nose at novels, which I was like, yay. You can see his short story writing here. Like this is a novel composed of a bunch of really interesting like flash stories, basically. And those little characters that come up and have a moment of dialogue and then recede are really compelling. There's one I flagged that I liked for multiple reasons. This is on page 206. The character is Miss Tamara Doolittle. Her passage begins at the very bottom. She says, "One thing I don't like is I am dumb. Everyone treats me like I am dumb all my life, and I am dumb. Even sewing for me is a hard one. My aunt, who raised me, sat hours showing me sewing. Do it like this, hun, she would say, and I would." And it goes on from there. It's just like a little short story, but I liked, first of all, I was like, I relate to that. I am dumb too. But also, I just liked that it was a little bit of dialogue, a little bit of character, and then I don't think she comes back at all. It's just that little touch, and you get this little sort of voice, a little sort of detail, and then it's gone. So it is kind of like reading a shit ton of flash fiction all at once and kind of getting that sort of like collage feel from it.
One of my favorite little chapters was the one with Jane Ellis and Abigail Blass, where Jane Ellis, like they're all lining up to talk to Willie Lincoln, and the first one who starts like has obviously just says this one speech over and over again and probably has for years. Oh, yeah. And so she's about to start speaking and the other woman's like, oh God, oh no, here she goes. Like she starts like mocking her and like saying it before her. And then she's like, no, don't crowd me. And then launches into the exact same speech that this woman has clearly heard thousands probably of times. I like that part. But and it also kind of illustrates like how differently the Bardo kind of affects the different ghosts. Like some of them are very clear-minded, some of them are completely obsessed or reduced to kind of one emotion or one expression, and some of them degrade over time and start off more sharp-minded, and then you can watch them like become less and less as the book goes on.
So I have some questions that one of them's related to that. Well, the first is, does Bardo mean anything else besides the Buddhist?
I don't think so.
Bardo?
I don't think so.
Okay. So, because I think like the moment in the book where all the ghosts like try to like jump into Lincoln.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out if that was like, were they trying to like inhabit him, or was, I couldn't quite figure out what that moment was actually about. Because typically a Bardo is like, it's like a reincarnation thing, right?
My sense is that a Bardo is like akin to like a limbo state where you're kind of between life and death. Like you haven't reincarnated yet. You're kind of waiting for your next cycle.
Right. But they're not trying to like reincarnate into Lincoln. So why are they trying to like go in? Like what was the purpose of them going into Lincoln?
They have this idea that if they can occupy him, they can sort of sway him into a particular action. So in that case, they wanted him to, what was it? They wanted him to try to convince Willie.
They wanted him to
move on.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they tell that story about how they're like proud of convincing a couple to stay together because they inhabited their bodies and had them fuck.
Right.
But then later on they're like, oh, by the way, they also like their marriage fell apart and then the wife killed herself. Right. It's like it gets fucking sad. So yeah, there is this like haunting thing they do. Gives them a slight sway or some sort of ability to sort of like nudge a real like a living person in some direction potentially.
And they themselves kind of think they're like, most of them are, I get the sense, aware that they're dead, but they're in denial about it.
Yeah, they keep talking about the coffins as sick boxes and as the cemetery yard as a hospital yard. Yeah, and they keep saying we're sick. And I was like, you're not.
All right, then off of that, what was all that stuff about like the demon carapace when like Willie's like turning into like a you remember that part?
Yeah.
On,
I had a hard time with that too. I think, and Dave, you can explain more here. My understanding was that for younger people, it's riskier to stay in the Bardo. And if you linger too long, you risk sort of like basically becoming like damned. Or like some sort of like this kind of like punishment where you are ossified in this like weird demon sack. And it doesn't happen for the older inhabitants of the Bardo because they're more fully developed, I guess. They're more kind of like they're adults since they don't have the same kind of, it's not as tragic for them to be. I don't know. Dave, is that track?
Yeah. And I think an example of like Willie's future is that girl who is stuck up against the fence and just like her existence is just horror.
So Willie's the Lincoln in the Bardo.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Okay. So then my last question, and this is maybe a little less pointed, why do we think Saunders chose Lincoln in the first place?
He was stuck on this. I think he was at a party and a friend or someone at the party was talking about this moment from history where it's rumored that Lincoln went to this crypt and actually took Willie's body out of the coffin and held it. You know, there's no proof or anything that actually happened, but it's something that has been carried through since then as like something that is rumored to have happened. So like that idea planted in him, or just that moment, like visualizing that moment.
But still, why Lincoln? Even if that moment stuck with him, why not have this story be about someone else doing that? Like, what's the significance of Lincoln?
Well, it seems the idea of grief here is important, and we're seeing it on a local level, but also like a national level, right? So this is the Civil War, and like the idea of like grieving for something's been lost in terms of like the idea of a a unified country. And also the Bardo, to me, felt like the same kind of like place in the middle where like, what's going to happen? Like what's during the Civil War? Like, so obviously people are dying in mass numbers, but on top of that, like what happens to the future of the country? Like if we don't solve this problem, like what's going to become of the United States? So it did feel like this sort of interesting sort of metaphor or parallel for the trauma of the Civil War and what it meant for the country.
Yeah, Lincoln's burying his own son while he's making decisions that are leading to thousands of other parents burying their own sons.
Yeah.
And one of the most fucked up parts for me was at the end. So spoilers ahead for Bardo readers. If you haven't read it by now and don't want to get the plot spoiled, go ahead and stop listening, because everything that's come before has been pretty general. This is going to get a bit heavier into plot details. When Willie finally realizes that he's dead and it sort of transcends.
Yep.
And Lincoln sort of has his moment of realization too. His realization is like, we have to kill more people, right? Like his lesson or his sort of his liberating moment is like, well, I have to go enact warfare and kill a lot more people in order to move forward and solve this problem. And it's heavy and it's hard because it has all the structure and language of a triumphant epiphany for a novel. It's like the character's like breakthrough moment, but it is like the worst thing. It's the idea of like, we're gonna have what, 4 more years of bloodshed and terror, and then we will and then moving forward will also not be great because like we're not going to solve.
Well, and it's full of uncertainty, right? Because I mean, he's literally enacting also a rebirth of the country. Like that's a very clear moment in history that like what it was stopped,
right?
And what it became was something else. And to be in that moment and choose pain but maybe hope at the same time, is that's got to be, you know, that's not unlike what Willie's being faced with at the same time.
Yeah,
just on a different scale.
Totally. But you're right. And the hope to me felt sour because it
pretty bittersweet. Yeah.
And I was really impressed with Saunders' willingness to show like the conclusion, the climax here is not happy. It's not good. It's awful. And you have to just live with that.
Yeah. Also, the last page is pretty sad.
Yeah. What did you guys think about the way that Saunders handles race in this novel? It's obviously, you can't talk about Lincoln, the Civil War, and not talk about race. I'm curious to hear thoughts on this.
There was some rough stuff to read in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that like weird. I don't know if she was being raped or a prostitute or both. That woman, what was her name?
I think it was both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's definitely both. But I mean, page 222, it was pretty rough. I mean, I think that plays into what I was just saying, right? Where like there's definitely a story here. Like Lincoln was a very specific choice in order for this not just to be a story about familial grief, right? This is also a story about like societal grief. Yeah. And I think that's, it would have been easy to write this book with almost any other historical figure and have it be pretty poignant. But like Lincoln's kind of the only choice, or not the only choice, but, you know, fits a small list of choices that can also have that secondary effect. And then, you know, the trauma that's enacted there is bad, but he's also, you know, choosing death when death's already all around him, right? And he's trying to enact some influence on that to cause suffering, to stop suffering is a difficult choice.
Yeah. And there's, Saunders does this really interesting thing with the rules of the Bardo too, and sort of how racism that is experienced in life transcends into death too, right? Like the black ghosts like don't get to be part of the cemetery, and they have to like,
yeah,
they have different relationship with the iron fence and the ghosts do, or the ghosts in the cemetery itself. It's a really, I found that to be really hard to take. Good. I mean, I don't think it's not a bad thing in the novel. It's just like, it's hit. I was like, God, this is horrible.
I mean, there's also that bit of irony where like the afterlife these racist ghosts are inhabiting is not the white Christian, white Christian afterlife, right? It's not purgatory.
Right.
Right. Their limbo is not what they spent their whole lives. That was the justification for half their bullshit. Right. And instead, you know, how many of them are going to come back as slaves or just not get the opportunity to?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Just sit there and rot.
Yeah. Just be lost in the Bardo forever and just sort of like continually try and figure out what you're doing and never be able to. Yeah. Heartbreaking.
Yeah. And there doesn't seem to be any like rhyme or reason to like what your fate is when once you get in there. Like, you know, some people get swallowed up by the ground and like frozen, and some people immediately do the batter light blooming and apparently get reincarnated, and can't really tell like what is like what's going to happen to what person. It's kind of random.
Doesn't seem karmic. Yeah.
But that's like the decision though, right? Is that everyone who's bloomed, I guess, has decided to be, has like accepted the fact that they're dead and need to move on.
Yeah. There's that scene where the angels come and like tempt them and try and get them to acknowledge, like there's that you're a wave that's crashed on the sand, whatever, which I think is a really nice line. And that scene reads, when you're first reading the novel, as like threat or horror, kind of. It's like these monstrous angels coming to like tempt you into the next stage, but then you get to the end and it's like, no, they're trying to help you. Like, this is a good thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there's also like one of the driving voices is a reverend. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Which is, I think, the most interesting.
Yeah. He's also the most either in denial. Do we know how he died? Does he know? I can't. He was a little harder for me to kind of understand than the others.
He has the mystery that's not solved in this novel, right? We don't know why he's damned. So he's the one who goes to, he accepts quickly the heaven. He wants to go, like, because he's a person of faith and wants to go live in eternity. He's waiting in line and seeing, you know, you at the gates, you're just, like, judged by these angels and this, like, you know, phantasmagoria kind of scene. And then he finds out that he's going to hell and he runs away back to the Bardo and refuses to return because he knows what's going to happen to him. But he never answers the question why he's damned. And so I definitely want to ask the three of you, like, what you thought was going on there. I think the answer is in the novel, but I'm not sure I know what it is necessarily, that I didn't read carefully enough.
Yeah, I don't either.
Dave, did you, you've read this novel 3 or 4 times. Do you have thoughts on that?
No, not at all.
The best thing I came up with was that I think that he is being punished for, like, assuming that faith is the only thing that matters, right? That just being religious and sort of speaking to, because the whole time he's like, what did I do? Like I said, I didn't kill, or I didn't cheat. I'm not a secret sinner. I don't lust. I didn't touch kids, whatever. Like, I'm a good person. Maybe I'm like sometimes wavered in my faith, but I wasn't like the degenerate or whatever, but still he's damned. And I guess I can think of, like, maybe that's not enough. Maybe the answer is that you can't just trust religion. You have to feel it, you know, more intuitively. But that's as close as I can get. I was still lost in that one a little bit.
Yeah, but there's also, you know, when you put that up against the slavery and race stuff in there, there's a lot of hypocrisy in that, you know, righteousness.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. I got really emotional at the end. I mean, I enjoyed this novel the whole way through, but the end really got to me. And it was not the Willie Lincoln's revelation didn't get to me really so much as Blevins and Volman realizing they're friends. And they like each other, and they sort of learn each other's lives and sort of accept. And there's this passage, let's see if I can find this, towards the end, page 334, where Bevins, I keep saying Blevins, because I went to school with someone named Blevins, which is why, where he thinks about all the things that life is, right? So he says, though the things of the world were still strong with me still, such as, for example, a gaggle of children trudging through a side-blown December flurry, a friendly match share beneath some collision-tilted streetlight, a frozen clock, bird visited with its high tower, cold water from a tin jug, toweling off one's clinging shirt post-June rain, pearls, rugs, buttons, rug tuft, beer froth, someone's kind wishes for you, someone remembering to write, someone noticing you are not at all at ease, a bloody roast death bread on a platter, a hedge top under a hand as you flee, and it goes on like this. And it really got to me, this like sort of catalog of small things about life that make it worth living. It's like that moment in Manhattan when Woody Allen's character does the litany of things that make sort of life worth living, kind of the same thing. It just really hit me. It's just like, that was the emotional beat for me. It was not the Lincoln story to me receded, and what was more important was the friendship story between the ghosts.
Yeah. And then on the very next page, I feel like their motivations for all the people stuck in the Bardo. You know, we talk about death here a fair amount. And I guess, Aaron, it's no big surprise that this book landed maybe a little harder with you and I for this reason. But then on the next page, after both Bevins and Volman have gone and we're just left with like some ghosts that we haven't even really spent much time with before, they're talking about their reasons for sticking around. And one says that we had again been granted the great mother gift. And then another character says time. And then another character says more time.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing there, right?
Right. But that's like this impossible to decipher moment where it's both painful and sad and also the most desirable thing ever is like, I want more time, but also my time is, what am I doing in the Bardo? I'm just walking around. Like, it's this, they've obviously made the wrong choice, but also they've made the only choice you can make, which is wanting to have more, right?
Right, exactly. I can't imagine that I would find it easy to leave the Bardo.
Oh, yeah, totally. I was terrifying thinking about it. Just the idea of like accepting death and accepting that there is going to be a endpoint to your story, and you're gonna have to at some point like come to grips with that, or you're just left in this lurch forever. Yeah, it got to me. It really, I was crying heavy tears in this book for sure. Other thoughts on this novel? Anything else he wants to share or talk about?
Not really. I mean, I think that, again, the last page was pretty devastating, where it kind of just implies that, like, his other kid's about to die too.
Yeah, that was heavy. And then also this enslaved person's monologue too, right? Where he's, that bit where he goes into the horse, like he's going through Lincoln and then goes to the horse, then kind of leaves the horse and goes back into Lincoln, and it's just like, that felt, I don't know. It was an interesting ending. The ending was less, it was still emotional, but it was a different kind of emotion for me. It was more like shock, I guess, than sort of like the kind of like sadness of the previous chapters. One brief connection. So the whole pandemic, I've been going to Mount Auburn Cemetery to walk around. It's a really beautiful cemetery, and it's right near my house. And I haven't been in a while because of winter. It's just a bit colder to walk around there. And also when it's snowy, it's just like, you know, it's very beautiful, but also can like get kind of muddy and gross. And I went back after I read this, I was like, I gotta go back to the cemetery. It's been too long since I've seen my cemetery friends. So I was enjoying thinking of Mount Auburn Cemetery as this other Bardo, and thinking about some people who are buried there and sort of what their situations might be. And I was doing some further looking on famous internments. We've talked about them before, a couple of them. I know Bernard Malamud was buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery, which is pretty cool. And there's a couple of famous people. But one person buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery who has a connection to this novel is Edwin Booth, who is John Wilkes Booth's brother, is buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery. And I was like, holy shit, like a weird connection to this story. And he was like a famous actor. He was like the most famous actor in America for a time. And then, so was John Wilkes Booth, also famous but not successful. And then he fell in with the like anarchist cabal and then shot the president.
That's got to be weird. Can you imagine if like Tom Hanks's brother shot Obama? Be yeah. Like, what the yeah. Fuck?
It's like that story that Woody Harrelson's dad was involved in the Kennedy assassination to some extent. It's like not true, but his dad was arrested in Dallas at the same time because he was also like a local criminal.
Yeah. Actually, it was Ted Cruz's dad.
Right, yeah.
Also, there's a very real chance that Randy Quaid commits an assassination.
I'm surprised he hasn't already.
Yeah, that guy is really fucked up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's like super crazy.
Yeah, and Dennis Quaid's also a right-wing creep, unfortunately. Sorry, Quaids, you're under the gun of this podcast. Yeah, I love this book. That was fantastic. I will read it again for sure. I think this is definitely a rereader, both in terms of format and also just I want to go back to it and spend some more time with it.
Something I didn't mention, which because I think I also need to read it again. This is the worst possible year and time for me to have read this book because it made me feel stupid. Because I've had such a hard time reading this year that I think this book would have been a lot easier for me to like understand kind of fully 2 or 3 years ago when I was reading competently.
Interesting.
before our societal COVID fog just fucked all our brains up. And right. Like to have this be like one of 5 books I've read in the last year made it, I think, a lot more difficult to penetrate than maybe it would have been. I didn't mean it sexually, Aaron.
I know. I didn't laugh. I just made a face.
So I'm going to read it again, maybe when I learn to read again.
Yeah, that makes sense. That sounds about right. Well, do you want to talk about that bad review in The Atlantic, Dave? I don't know if I want to get too much into it. There's one review from The Atlantic by a novelist that I found and texted to Dave because I was like, have you read this? It makes some weird points about like the critique is a lot like, well, these characters are dead, so how it's like weird that you can hear their thoughts, whatever. And it's like, yeah, they're ghosts.
It was like, yeah, this isn't really realistic. I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah, it was like, this novel's not playing by the rules of ghosts. Like, you mean the fake things that don't exist? Like,
yeah, so it was really weird.
Yeah, also, you ever read George Saunders before?
Yeah, well, he does.
It's like a review you'd find on Goodreads and be like, yeah, but this was in The Atlantic.
Yeah, and it goes really into depth with how Saunders, he's like, Saunders's earlier work is more biting and dark, and for him to try and talk about hope is wrong. I don't know. It felt weird. It was a weird review. The one thing I did agree with that review, though, a little bit, is it does get kind of like, there is a little bit of schmaltz this novel. I didn't find it to be bad, but I did notice, I was like, this is a little bit wet-eyed, but I was wet-eyed when I read it, so that makes sense. Also, there is there's this New York Times virtual reality film adaptation of this novel that is, I don't know, maybe worth checking out if you're interested in it. It's weird. It feels like a high school play version of the novel, but it is, I don't know, if you have the VR app from the New York Times, probably would be more fun for you to expose or encounter that.
Fuck the New York Times. pretty over them. Sorry.
Well, listeners, tell us your thoughts on Lincoln the Bardo. Can you pronounce it? Do people freak out when you say the word, the title to them? Did you like it? On Twitter at YakBabies, and also email us, yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com, with all your thoughts and details. Then also patreon.com/yakbabies, access to our bonus podcast for $1 a month. You can sort of get all those bonus pods. There's a lot of fun over there. There's games, there's power hours, there's bro to bro segments. There's lots of stuff happening on the Patreon, and it's all worth that dollar. Otherwise, we have merch as well. Until then, YakBabies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all their loyal listeners, and especially their patrons, both past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, Roger, Kathleen, Bailey, Andrew, and William Howard Taft.